This week.
Jamais.
Never since the creation of the African Union has there been such a large number of transitions following and constitutional changes of government in Africa.
African Union leaders gather in Ethiopia against a difficult economic and political backdrop. Coups, conflicts, and regional tensions, even as African countries explore the promise of free trade. We'll look at what came out of the AU summit and how the bloc has fared in its plan to transform the African continent into a global powerhouse. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. We're coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining us. Leaders representing 55 African countries gathered in Ethiopia over the weekend for the 37th annual African Union Summit as parts of the continent wrestle with coups, conflicts, political crises and regional tensions. AU Commission Chairperson Musa Faki Mahamat opened the conference with a somber assessment, saying the problems plaguing Africa have not gotten any better.
Our main challenges have not diminished. Peace, political and institutional instability, climate change, deficits in economic governance, integration, poverty, the marginalization of women and young people in development process, and leadership in our political and social systems remain our main sources of concern.
Well, the summit came at a time when there have been multiple coups in West Africa, a region that has dealt with instability and democratic backsliding.
Non-constitutional changes of government have multiplied in total defiance of the entire political and legal system on which our organization was founded. Never since the creation of the African Union has there been such a large number of transitions following and constitutional changes of government in Africa.
Well, now critics have long accused the African Union of being ineffectual and taking little decisive action in the face of numerous conflicts and power grabs. But the bloc is also credited with launching one of the world's largest free trade areas. And that is our focus today. Is the AU delivering on its master plan to, quote, transform Africa into the global powerhouse of the future? Now, we will discuss that in a moment. But first, another item on the AU's radar. In Addis Ababa this weekend was the Israel-Hamas war. The International Court of Justice has begun historic hearings into the legality of Israel's 57-year occupation of lands sought for a Palestinian state. Over the course of 6 days, 52 states and three organizations, including the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and the African Union, will present arguments related to Israel's open-ended control over the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Israel says it doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the hearings and won't attend. Now, this case is separate from South Africa's genocide case at The Hague and predates Israel's bombardment of Gaza in response to the October 7th Hamas attacks. And now here to tell us more is VOA correspondent Ignatius Annell. He joins me here in studio. Ignatius, it has been a minute and a warm welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. Great to have you. I want to get right into it. This is now the third case involving Israel at the International Court of Justice. Please walk us through what happened last week when South Africa approached the court about Israel's planned Rafah ground offensive.
Well, thank you, Heidi, for having me. It's always great to be pleasure. With you, and thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here. So on the 12th of February, South Africa, for the second time, went to the International Court of Justice, or the World Court, as it's called globally. And this time, the request was very simple. The country was asking for additional measures that will stop Israel from its, you know, impending ground invasion of the southern city of Rafah in Gaza. Currently, Gaza has roughly about 1.5 Palestinians who have already been displaced since Israel launched its attack, its counterattack, following the Palestinian attack on October the 7th of last year. South Africa is now saying that we have gone beyond saying that we're accusing Israel of genocide, but saying it is punishing the people of Gaza. And so we're asking the World Court to give additional measures. What the court then said, 4 days after South Africa sent the request, the 15 justices issued a statement, and they said that we already issued an interim measure pending the core of the case that South Africa has sent. Remember, that was for the court to stop the military intervention that Israel is undertaking. It says that we already issued preliminary measures asking Israel to ensure that they protect all Palestinians in Gaza and also make sure that they opened up the country for humanitarian aid and fuel to get into Gaza. So essentially, the World Court declined the request that South Africa brought just because they had issued the first response or the ruling that says that we expect Israel to protect these people and avoid genocidal acts in Gaza.
And that Rafah offensive you were talking about, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying that ground offensive will begin by Ramadan, which is around March 10th or 11th, if Israeli hostages held by Hamas and other groups are not released. But now, Ignatius, these current hearings about Israel are about Israel's control over the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem. What do the 52 states and the three organizations, including the AU and including South Africa, what do they want the court to do here with these hearings currently taking place?
On Tuesday, which was yesterday, we heard from the South African ambassador resident in the Netherlands, and he had said, and I quote him correctly, that Israel's occupation of the three areas that you've mentioned, West, East Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, and then the West Bank, is fundamentally illegal. What they are asking the World Court to do is to rule that the occupation is illegal and that Israel basically hands off those territories without any condition. When you hear from the South African representatives, what they said was, quote unquote, that they not only hear, see, and feel the pain of the Palestinians people, because South Africa as a country had experienced apartheid between 1948 and 1994. It is for that reason they are saying that we think that we're responsible. We want to hold the international community to account and also make sure that the people of Gaza are protected by ensuring that there is a ruling that binds Israel to basically literally hands off those territories.
Now, Ignatius, there's been a lot of activity now at the ICJ. But in real terms, the last time with the January 26th ruling, the court stopped short of ordering a ceasefire. So the South Africans celebrated that, what they saw as a victory, at least on moral terms, on January 26th. But what has it really changed for ordinary people in their daily lives living in Gaza?
That's a great question, Haiti. So if you look at the fact that South Africa decided to hold Israel to account on what they see to be an illegality and repression or discrimination against the Palestinians, what they are saying here is that we think that the suffering of these people would increase if there is no concrete measures or people do not hold Israel to account. Now, as we speak now, as I said early on, 1.4 million Palestinians have left other parts of Gaza and are literally just, being refugee in the south of the country, which is Rafah, for example. If South Africa had not taken this case to the World Court, what analysts have even told me, for example, is that what will be seen will be much more severe than what we have seen. So essentially, it looks like South Africa's request to the court is making some gains. People are not, dealing with the sort of things they would have dealt with had there not been a ruling from the World Court.
Even so, at the same time, you're seeing there is a little bit of a tussle inside the United States thinking on how far to support Israel on this. The Israelis, of course, Israeli Prime Minister, especially rubbishing the court's rulings and, of course, rejecting accusations of apartheid here. But we've heard references of the plight of Palestinians at the recent AU summit, especially during speeches. It's a tall order, of course, to expect all 54, 55 countries in the African Union to speak with one voice all the time on every topic. But where do African countries more or less stand on the Israel-Hamas war? I mean, we haven't really seen other countries come out to the same extent that South Africa has.
Haiti, I would answer this question by giving you an example of what happened 2 years ago when Russia invaded Ukraine. What we saw from the African Union and indeed the 54-member bloc is that of full support for Russia, for example. And we saw even, you know, at the General Assembly when the votes were held, most either African states, you know, abstained from the vote or voted against what, you know, the United States, for example, was trying to achieve by saying that Russia doesn't have the right to invade Ukraine. We haven't seen that when it comes to the issue of Israel and then Gaza, for example. What we have seen is locals, indigenous African people, taking to their social media, even protesting in countries like Tunisia, in countries like Algeria, in Ghana, in Kenya. We've seen local people say that free Palestine, but we also have not heard them categorically condemn the assault of the Palestinian militant group Hamas on southern Israel on October the 7th. When the African Union summit happened over the weekend, Moussa Faki Mohamed indeed commended South Africa and says that the African Union was fully in support of the processes that South Africa is taking at the International Court of Justice. So it's a double-edged sword where the people are saying they're free Palestine, but we have the African Union as a bloc of the region saying that we support exactly what Pretoria is doing at the World Court.
And things become tricky when you've got some wars and conflicts on your own doorstep to deal with as well. Ignatius, and
let me just quickly say that Israel, for example, had said, you know, last year they submitted a report to in response to the accusations made by South Africa, claiming that they, you know, are committing genocidal acts in Gaza. And they have said that they are not doing that and that they have respected international laws and would not sit back for Hamas to attack them, that they have the right to protect themselves.
Very interesting situation indeed. Ignatius Anno, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you for helping us understand this and walking us through it all. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Well, still to come here on Straight Talk Africa, we'll take a closer look at the results of the African Union summit. Has the AU become more or less effective in addressing the challenges on the African continent? More after the break. Stay with us.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Played a crucial role in the Sudanese revolution that eventually ousted President Omar al-Bashir. Women were also instrumental in the establishment of a new country, South Sudan. They are now calling for an end to fighting and hostilities that have persisted in both countries. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we'll hear the voices of women in Sudan and South Sudan who advocate for peace and stability. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in
here with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. We're discussing the recent African Union summit held in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. Has the AU been effective in delivering on its so-called master plan to transform Africa into a global powerhouse of the future? Well, my guests this week are David Monda. He's a professor of political science at City University of New York, and he joins us from New York. Also with us is Chido Mutangadura. She is a senior fellow on governance, peace and security with the United Nations University, and she joins us from the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. Chido and Prof, a warm welcome to both of you. David Monda, I'm going to start off with you here. How would you describe the mood and the tone of the 37th AU summit?
I think the mood was deliberative. But the mood also emphasized a lot of what has been achieved and ultimately also a lot of what is still to be done. And I'm thinking specifically in relation to the questions around improving the security infrastructure on the continent through, for example, the Peace and Security Council, on matters of democracy, good governance, and human rights through, for example, the Lome Convention passed in 2000 and the governance conventions that have been passed by the AU, but also reflecting on some of the challenges going forward, specifically around reform of the AU, reform of its institutions, how the AU recruits staff, and more broadly, sustainable funding for the institution.
Prof, deliberative indeed. There was a lot to deliberate on. Chido, what was your main takeaway from this year's gathering?
I think the main takeaway definitely is the idea that that they're entering the operational phase of the African Free Trade Continental Agreement in light of really some of the big challenges that are there in improving trade between African countries. I mean, there are quite a lot of barriers there that I feel there really hasn't been quite a realistic discussion into how this can become operational in light of the difficulties in connectivity between the countries, as well as the increasing tensions between the countries. And so the fact that we are moving forward, where we're seeing a lot more intra-state tensions that can go into conflict, and then on the other side, this very optimistic, free trade is going to go on. I think that sort of, I think that contrast for me is very, very interesting.
Chido, I'm glad you brought up the free trade area. I want to come back to that a little later on and talk about some of its benefits. But, Prof, back to you. The summit coincided with the Munich Security Conference, which was another reminder of the conflict and security threats we as a world face today. Africa, of course, has not been spared when it comes to conflict, when it comes to tensions and threats to democracy. How worried should the African Union be as a regional bloc about what we're seeing in parts of West Africa, in parts of East Africa, in particular?
I think the union should be very worried. And it's interesting you mentioned the Munich Security Conference, because a lot of the conflicts on the continent are essentially forgotten, or the world develops compassion fatigue. So at this point, a lot of the emphasis right now is the war between Ukraine and Russia, and what's going on between Israel and Hamas in the occupied territories in the Middle East. But we do have numerous conflicts on the continent. The wars in the DRC have been going on for years. Millions of people have died. We have the war in Sudan and a range of different challenges across the board. But I should also add that one of the biggest challenges for the AU has been improving the robustness of its institutions, and specifically in relation to civil wars, the Peace and Security Council and the African Standby Force. If you look, for example, at the conditions of what's happened in the DRC, We had a challenge with the diplomatic infrastructure, where on one hand we had the Nairobi peace process and then the Luanda peace process. And then at one point we had the East African force, which was put into the DRC and then pulled out. And then the UN was pulled out, and now SADC has been brought in, right? And then SADC troops, recently South African troops, were facing some debt. So I think that's one of the major challenges in terms of our security infrastructure, in terms of the capacity of the continent to respond to this crisis. But I think more broadly is the question of good governance, which leads to a lot of this instability, where whether we're thinking about coup d'etats and extra constitutional methods of individuals trying to access power.
Chido, the African Union has this master plan of transforming the African continent into a global powerhouse. It's part of the AU's Agenda 2063, the Africa we want. How has the AU, in your view, fared in its work to deliver on that agenda?
I think for the AU, a lot of credit can be given in terms of trying to lay down some of the structures in order to implement this vision. I think one of the biggest achievements has, for me recently, has definitely been joining the G20. But the question then is, you know, as you mentioned before, it's really quite a tall order to sort of have this continental body trying to represent 54 different countries that are in different type of situations. But I think there has been a really a lot of progress in terms of laying down the structures. The question now is on operationalizing the structures. So I think the AU has done quite good work on developing this policy framework. But the main challenge that is facing the continent is that some of the barriers in order to implement these issues are really linked to governance and human rights situations in specific countries. And this is something that the AU really has struggled over and over with in addressing, especially issues around constitutional coups and political issues. And then additionally, I think just to add on what Prof said, is looking at the structure, the conflict management structures of it, and looking at the AU going more towards militarization. And this is the ASF is working more at a regional level. And I think what I've been seeing is a bit of a gap between when we see regional forces deploy and then the AU sort of trying to build up on that and reinforce those efforts.
But Prof, Rwanda's President Paul Kagame handed over the baton to President William Ruto of Kenya this weekend. He will now lead the AU's institutional reforms. This is always an issue with big, outfits like the AU, even at the UN too. But what does this mean now for the AU, and what is President Ruto expected to accomplish with this baton?
He's expected to accomplish a lot, and his agenda is full. And I'd specifically highlight two tensions here. So we have the annual heads of government meeting, which, really tends to historically, whether it was the OAU or the AU, really emphasize the oversized role of presidents, right, of heads of government. But I don't think the AU has really empowered the commission, the AU commission and the president of the commission to actually do these day-to-day reforms, because President Ruto will be a figurehead again, will centralize a lot of this on the heads of state. But really, the bureaucrats within the AU and the commission have not really been empowered. And another example I could give is the Pan-African Parliament. In Pretoria in South Africa, which is supposed to be the equivalent of, the Brussels,
the European Parliament, in
Brussels. But, the AU Parliament is really consultative. It doesn't have any teeth, right? So it can't really make law and enforce those laws. And I must lastly add, in addition to the challenges President Ruto will be facing, is this question of sovereignty, where heads of government do not want interference from the AU within their internal internal affairs. And I think this also creates an issue, whether it's about the Pan-African Parliament actually having teeth, whether it's about the AU Commission actually enforcing a lot of these reforms, which in many cases will ironically receive a lot of resistance from heads of government who in some cases, in many cases, are doing unconstitutional things within their countries, but do not want to be regulated or looked over by the AU or by anybody else.
Chido, when we look to the future, what was, as you mentioned earlier, the AU's flagship initiative, of course, the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, or ACFTA. The UN calls it the world's most youth and women-friendly trade agreement. What is your assessment of how well that free trade area has been working in terms of improving lives in Africa's, of the lives of Africa's women and young people, especially when you still see such high unemployment rates in even the most successful economy on the continent?
Thank you. I think, for us to be fair to the AU, the establishment of the free trade agreement really almost coincided with the beginning of COVID-19, and then coming out of that with so many global shocks. So ultimately, it does feel like the implementation of this area, agreement has been swimming against the current. But in terms of it being, you know, very women-friendly, very youth-friendly, I have to say I'm not very optimistic, because this is not the only instance where we see the AU leading in terms of pushing these type of norms, right, where it's very much, you know, a global trendsetter, and yet it doesn't translate at all well on the ground. Looking at the free trade agreement, for example, there's been very little in the way of implementation. I think a little bit more now with South Africa exporting refrigerators to countries like Kenya, if I'm not mistaken, and a little bit of trade that has been happening between Rwanda and Ghana. But in and of itself, I think there hasn't been a lot of progress. And I think even in terms of the progressive language, I have to be honest and say I'm not extremely optimistic that there will be changes. There will be sort of very significant changes for women and very significant, opportunities for young people as well.
Prof, if you can add to that in about 1 minute, I'd appreciate it. What's your take on what the free trade area has accomplished?
I think it's brought the continent closer together, thinking more of, around questions of de-dollarization, questions of better trade between and within African states. But I think a lot still needs to be done, and specifically around removal of non-tariff barriers between states, also implementation and ratification of a lot of the accords that have been passed. But lastly, the Open Skies and Yamoussoukro Accord, which was supposed to have been implemented, but there's still a lot of resistance to that, to the Open Skies and actually integrating how Africans can easily fly from one country to another. I think those are areas that need to be looked at again.
Well, we'll keep looking at them. There's still a long year ahead. But, you know, before you open your eyes, it will be 2063. So we hope we see some more progress in coming years. Professor David Monda and Chido Mutangadura. Chido, your first time on the show. Welcome. And, of course, we'd like to have you back again here. But thanks to both of you for your time and for your insight. I really do appreciate it. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you to the more than 300 affiliate TV and radio stations that carry this show every week so you can watch. Thanks to all my guests, and thank you for always watching and always listening. I will see you next time. Until then, it's goodbye.